During the summer of 1964, two geniuses of the stage and screen, Samuel Beckett and Buster Keaton, joined forces for one of the most unusual collaborations ever. It involved Beckett's first and only screenplay. 50 years later, archivist and director Ross Lippman has not only restored the film, which was called simply Film, but made a feature documentary about it called Not Film, which opens tomorrow at Anthology Film Archives on 2nd Avenue and 2nd Street and at theaters around the country. I'm very pleased to welcome Ross Lippman to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What kind of response did it get when it was first released?
Well, I think that mixed is probably the best way to describe it. A lot of people were baffled, and some were celebrating Keaton. I think Lost in the Shuffle was Beckett's original vision for what was intended. There's a great story that when it premiered at the Venice Film Festival in 1965, Beckett, of course, didn't attend. He never went to such things. But Keaton did go. He was in. He was escorted there by Raymond Rauhauer, the famous film raconteur, pirate, and promoter. And so it was kind of a celebration of Keaton's career that he was coronated at Venice, basically. But he was going around saying how he really didn't understand the film himself, and he was quite verbose on that topic. And so Beckett then wrote to Alan Schneider in a letter.
Who the man who directed it.
Yes, to Alan Schneider, the director of film. He said, well, I didn't go, of course, but Buster was there parading his ignorance. And I think that you know, I think he was actually quite friendly with Keaton. So that comment might have, you know, not really been as pointed as it sounds, but it was funny because Lost in the Shuffle was Beckett's film.
But since Keaton not only starred in films but directed films, you could understand why this film, which is totally opposite in its vision, might have made him feel that way.
Oh, absolutely. And he was really not brought in as part of the creative team per se. I mean, by that time, Beckett was, of course, very well established. He hadn't won the Nobel yet, but this is...
But he did get a standing ovation at Venice.
Yes, but I think it was Keaton that got the ovation, if I may. I don't know if that's... You know, I wasn't there, of course. I mean, I was 1 year old at that time. But, you know, film festivals are wonderful, but, you know, they have a momentum of their own. And I think that people were so excited to have Buster Keaton there after this period of semi-invisibility. He was quite active in his later years, but he was not getting the more prestigious productions that he had been involved in the earlier parts of his career. And so this was a last moment of glory, if you will, for Buster.
What happened to the film after that?
You know, it did distribute a little bit. It was shown, you know, at art houses. It had a run in New York a few years later, and basically made its way quietly around art houses, cinematheques, and universities, but was not, it never made the big time. It never got to a wider audience.
And then it kind of disappeared. When did you first hear about it?
Well, I became aware of it quite young because Beckett wrote this wonderful script version that was printed by Grove Press. And the Grove Press edition has Beckett's copious notes, curious illustrations, quotes from, you know, the Irish philosopher George Berkeley, and Barclay is the correct pronunciation. And this script was such an oddity that I found it when I was about 19 years old. I was an undergraduate. I just came across it. And it immediately struck me as this wonderfully inventive approach to cinema that had in some ways great resonance with the whole history of cinema before it, and in other ways was veering off in its own direction. And so it stayed in my head for many, many years.
But you've worked on many other projects. You were here when we talked about Killer of Sheep, which you'd helped restore. You've also did The Connection, Shadows, Wanda. Were they more easily found than this one? Was there a reason that it took you so long to get around to this one?
Well, I worked for many years as a film restorationist. I'm still doing that work as well. But how projects arrive on one's plate as a film restorationist is a mysterious process. I was working for many years for the UCLA Film and TV Archive, and some of those projects are handed to you, and those are wonderful projects, and others you can if you're lucky, find a way to initiate.
Well, did you have to go on a treasure hunt to find this material?
Well, there's so many different pieces of material. The restoration started actually through a New York connection. My good friend Andrew Lampert from Anthology Film Archives called me because he was in dialogue with Barney and Astrid Rosset, and something in their conversation led Andy to believe that I would be a great person to restore films. So he reached out to me, and I said, oh, my God, I would love to restore film.
Now, the Rossets were publishers.
Yes.
So how did they get involved in this?
Well, Barney was, of course, Beckett's American publisher. He, in many ways, helped bring Beckett to the U.S. audience in very early on. 1953, 1954 was when he was first meeting with Beckett in France through his connection with Dick Seaver. And so Barney had long been wishing to make films. He had actually produced Strange Victory by Leo Hurwitz, which just played at BAM Cinematheque last week. And he wanted to return to film, even though he had by this time started to build his wonderful publishing empire.
Grove Press.
Yes. And so he reached out to Beckett and to other Grove authors to write short scripts that would be then made into an omnibus film. So he reached out to Ionesco and to Genet and Duras, and not all of them replied. But Beckett was the first in line, and they produced film. It ate up the entire budget, so the other films were never made. So Barney was, in fact, the producer of film.
Had Beckett shown much of an interest in film before?
Yes and no. He had been very interested in it as a youth in his 30s. He was in the 1930s, rather. He was very, very interested in cinema. In fact, he had written to Sergei Eisenstein to see if he could go study at the VGIK Film School in Moscow. Eisenstein did not reply, and as it turns out, Beckett never did go. But this, and he had also written on cinema in his letters to his friend Thomas McGreevy. It was quite a serious interest of his.
And when he wrote the screenplay, was he looking to do something very different from what he could do on the stage?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, the fact that he titled his sole work for cinema film shows you a little bit about what his interest in the medium itself was. Of course, he was very interested in exploring different media forms. He had done radio plays before then, and those were intended very much for the radio. And he was against, for many years, TV or film adaptations of his plays. He did allow them to happen on occasion. In general, he wasn't fond of it. So when he explored film as a medium, this was very much about film, and the title is not an accident.
Although when you see a play like Waiting for Godot, you can't help but notice that he must have been influenced by the silent comedians who he had watched when he was a kid.
Absolutely. But then there is, of course, you know, the music hall tradition as well, which a lot of that then vaudeville, that same tradition, there was dialogue back and forth in those performative styles that he was interested in. But yes, absolutely. He was interested in...
Well, they all wear bowlers, I guess. That's from the music hall tradition?
I don't know the whole history of the bowler and where it... But yes.
Now, did you... And when you were looking for the material, did you uncover any treasures, things that you hadn't expected?
Oh, well, absolutely. There were a number of things. I should start by mentioning the lost prologue to the film. Those of us who had seen the Grove Press edition, not only did it have Beckett's copious notes and curious script, but there was also a wonderful account of the making of the film by director Alan Schneider. And Schneider goes into great detail describing this prologue, which they shot but did not include in the film. They ran into technical troubles. It was supposed to be almost a third of the film originally. And this loomed large, not just in my consciousness and in Schneider's and anybody who had read that, but also in Barney Rossett's. Barney lived in this wonderful four-story walk-up on Fourth Avenue, and whenever I would go to New York, I would go and visit Barney. And as everyone did when they visited Barney, you would sit and you would have rum and cokes with him. And virtually every time I came to New York, I would go and visit with Barney, and he would talk so much about the lost prologue because, from a producer's standpoint, that was going to be their showpiece. He had put 4/5 of the budget into just that one scene, which never even made it into the film. And he was lamenting that it was lost. And as an archivist, I've learned to very carefully cultivate these conversations. You want to see if there's anything else remaining, but you also don't want to be too aggressive and impinge onto people's personal lives. So you gently explore, oh, do you have any other materials on the film? And Barty said, oh, well, yeah, we do have some scraps. We do have some scraps, and there's the Keaton outtakes, because there were some Keaton outtakes that a few people had seen before. But the prologue's lost. I said, well, would you mind if I maybe did an inspection on those things? And Barney graciously agreed, and to my surprise, they were under his kitchen sink. They had a little cupboard under his sink. So this is after, knowing him for a couple of years, I'm brought into the inner depths, which is the next room over, and under his sink there he's got a box of film. It's like, oh, okay. So I brought it back with me to Los Angeles, and when I was inspecting the film, it was not just scraps from the cutting room floor. This had all of the prologue, everything that had been shot. And so I've been able to reconstruct the lost prologue that's been described for many years. So this is a lost scene from Beckett's work.
I'm speaking with Ross Lipman, who's the director of a film. He's an archivist. He's director of the film Not Film, which opens tomorrow at the Anthology Film Archives at 32 Second Avenue at 2nd Street. And then it'll be shown around the country as well. So let's talk about Buster Keaton. Hadn't he turned down the role of Lucky for the American premiere of Waiting for Godot?
Yes, he had.
Was he his first? Was he Beckett's first choice for starring in this film?
There are different accounts of who Beckett's first choice was. Keaton was certainly not the first choice. According to some accounts, it was Chaplin. According to others, it was Jackie McGowran. And Zero Mostel was also considered. There were other options as well.
He wound up in Waiting for Godot, Zero Mostel.
Yes, that's right. We have a clip of him in Not Film. And so Keaton was a late addition, and really, in many ways, a wonderful last-minute solution, because despite the fact that they weren't all on the same page, he really does carry the role beautifully.
But he wears a signature pork pie hat, which is one of the ways we identify him. Was there a debate over whether he should even do that?
That was Keaton's request. He asked if he could, and they said certainly. They had no it fit in. The character, as you suggested, was very much based in this line of silent comedy and music hall traditions, and Keaton was, of course, a great product of that himself, and they were very happy with that.
Now, you devote much of the film also to talking about Alan Schneider, the director, and to Boris Kaufman, who was one of the greatest cinematographers in the history of movies, and you wonder what he was doing working on a film like this.
Absolutely, yeah. Boris Kaufman was a late addition. I believe that he was brought in. Most of the cast and crew was brought in by Schneider. Kaufman, I believe, was brought in by Rossett, because Rossett was a huge fan of Jean Vigo's Zero for Conduct, which was shot by Kaufman, a wonderful, beautifully poetic anarchist parable, in a way, of a revolt at a boys' boarding school. And it was really fortuitous, because Kaufman is one of the masters of light. When we showed the restoration of film a number of years ago, when that premiered, there was an audience member who came up to me and said, that looked like it was shot by Sven Nykvist. Kaufman is really just a master, and I think that's part of what makes film hold up as well as it does.
How did Leonard Maltin, of all people, figure in this story?
Yes, Leonard was then 13 years old, and he woke up one morning and found a story in the New York Times that Buster Keaton was in New York and filming a movie. And so this story is recounted in Not Film, but he wound up going there and meeting Buster Keaton on set at age 13. So Leonard tells more of that story in Not Film.
Did Beckett enjoy his time in New York City?
I think he was certainly not inspired to come back. I think that he was very glad that he did it once in his life. I think that, it was partly the excitement of seeing New York, partly excitement of being on a film shoot. And so, there's funny stories about him, attending a Mets double feature. And there's wonderful anecdotes about that, too.
So you went to a Mets game.
A doubleheader.
Uh-huh.
Well, did I say double feature? Yeah,
doubleheader. In 1964, the Mets were a woeful team. So
yes, yes. But he
dutifully that would have fit in perfectly with Beckett's negative view of the world.
Yes, and Dick Seaver brought him in. Beckett was the one who insisted that they stay for the second game because you're supposed to. Now, this, of course, followed the fact that he had just written Play in shortly before that was his play, in which the same action is repeated twice.
So Play and then film.
Yes.
Do you have any other thing in the works now?
Or well, before
any other hidden treasures? Because we've run out of time.
Yeah, I'll just mention that we have these wonderful audio recordings of Beckett in production with Kaufman and Schneider. It's a very rare chance to hear Beckett in production on film.
Archivist Ross Lippman is the director of Not Film, which opens tomorrow at the Anthology Film Archives at 32 Second Avenue at 2nd Street. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thanks so much.